The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by six local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Midpoint Library System, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. You are listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. We've got the best of the Book Nook coming up for you this morning. We're going to go back into our archive to an interview we recorded back in 2001 with a gentleman who was one of our best-selling crime writers. He called himself Ed McBain, but that was just one of his pen names. He also called himself Evan Hunter, which was a name that he legally adopted in 1952. But that was not his original name. We'll be talking to Ed McBain from the Book Nook Archives coming up following NPR News. Good morning. Welcome to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and we went into our archive and pulled out an interview recorded 15 years ago with a gentleman who called himself Ed McBain. Ed McBain put out over 50 novels in a crime series, and really outstanding crime novels. Ed McBain also wrote under his name Evan Hunter, and he came out to Yellow Springs in 2001 to do this interview. We had hoped to talk to him earlier in the year, but he was experiencing some health issues. And fortunately, he rescheduled, and he came to see us in the Book Nook in September of 2001 to talk about his novel, Money, Money, Money. Here's Ed McBain from the best of the Book Nook.
Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Ed McBain. He has a new novel of the 87th Precinct that's called Money, Money, Money. Welcome.
Hi, good to be here.
This is really a treat. You know, we had hoped to see you earlier in the year, and here you are.
Here I am. I had what is known as a AAA operation, an aorta of the an aneurysm of the abdominal aorta. I can't even say it. It frightens me to this day. Which if it would have burst, I would be dead. But it didn't burst because we had it repaired in Cleveland at the Cleveland Clinic. And here I am.
And at the time, you had you had just put out Candyland, which was a collaboration between Ed McBain and Evan Hunter. Now, how does that work?
Well, it didn't start out to be a collaboration. It was... I was starting to write a straight novel, you know. I hate to use the word serious because I consider the mysteries I write pretty serious, too. But a straight novel by Evan Hunter, a study of a sex addict. And I finished the book, and it was a reasonable length, a little short perhaps for a full-length novel. And then I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if the novel didn't end here? But if Ed McBain picked it up and it turned into a mystery where the people in the first half of the novel suddenly are involved in a police investigation. And I did it. And I said to myself, this would give me a wonderful opportunity, A, to show the difference between the styles of Evan Hunter and Ed McBain, and B, to show the very real differences between a straight novel and a mystery novel. And I combined them into one book called Candyland.
Which just came out in paperback. How would you compare the styles?
I think the Evan Hunter has a more leisurely pace to it. Any Evan Hunter novel has a more leisurely pace. There's still, I feel that any novel should be suspense, you know, that you should be able to... say to yourself, what's coming next, what's happening next, the same way I do when I'm writing it. But there's more room in a straight novel for interior monologues, for ruminations on matters, you know. In a mystery novel, the pace is much faster and there's more a concern with keeping going, a headlong pace, you know, when I'm writing it.
Uh-huh. And speaking of which, you have a new Ed McBain, Money, Money, Money. And this was, what did you say, the 51st in the series?
51st in the series. Guess 51st. What it's about.
Well, it looks like $100 bills from looking at the cover here.
Yeah. you know, I don't know if you know that the $100 bill is the most widely, U.S. $100 bill is the most widely used currency in the world. And this is about $100 bills, real ones, fake ones, good ones, bad ones, and all the people pursuing them.
You wrote the first book in this series in what, 1956? Is that right?
Mm-hmm. It was May of 1956. The first one was called Cop Hater. And I liked the title because I thought a lot of people in America don't like cops. And this is going to be the start of a series. I had a contract for 3 books. They said, we'll give you a contract for 3 books. We'll see how it goes. This is number 51. But I thought it would be fun to call the book Cop Hater, especially since it was treating with cops sympathetically.
Now, your first novel that was published was also published by Simon & Schuster, wasn't it?
Yeah, The Blackboard Jungle, uh-huh. By Evan Hunter Young. Uh-huh. And that was an interesting experience for me because the book itself sold moderately well for a first novel. Back then, a good sale for a first novel was about 20,000 copies, and it sold about 30 or something like that. And MGM bought the movie rights, and the movie came out at the same time that the paperback was released. And the paperback just went through the roof, but it was entirely due to the sensation that the movie caused. You know, it was a very good movie and a movie that really spoke about something Americans were not talking about at that time. You know, problems in the schools.
Let's talk about some of these cops. You have two cops in this one who have been in most of the books. Tell us about these guys. Now, the one guy, the Italian fella.
Steve Carella.
He's kind of your main man, isn't he?
He's normally in all of the books. He doesn't always play a leading role. Let me explain how I first discussed the concept with Pocketbooks, Inc. They were pocketbook paperback originals when the series first started. And I told them I wanted to do a series about a police series that would be firmly rooted in reality, where cops would come and go. They'd be transferred. They'd get killed. They'd get wounded. We would concentrate on cops as human beings first, and then cops. Now, I know, and I said we would deal with the entire squad room. When we put all the cops in that squad room together, we'd have the hero. It'd be a conglomerate hero. Now, I know this sounds very familiar to any of you who watch television, but I promise you that in 1956, this was a unique idea and a revolutionary one in many respects. So, In the beginning, the idea was that the cops could come and go. Over the years, Carella has sort of moved to the forefront as the hero. But still, in many books, I can remember one of the books where he was absolutely wrong-headed about something and had the wrong idea about who the killer was and just kept bullheadedly going for that, you know. And another cop was the hero of that book. I think of it as a repertory company of players. And one week you play Hamlet, and the next week you're a soldier on the battlefield in Henry V.
Uh-huh.
You know?
You have a lot of fun with Fat Ollie in this one.
Fat Ollie. I forget now which book he was introduced in. I think it was a book called Bread. Which, oddly enough, just occurs to me as a synonym for money, isn't it? But Fat Ollie Weeks. His full name is Oliver Wendell Weeks. And he's a consummate bigot. Hates everything and everybody except food. And he's a good cop. He knows he's a bigot. I'm not even sure he does. I think he just thinks this is the way everybody thinks. You know, doesn't everybody hate Jews? Doesn't everybody hate blacks? I think this is how his mind functions, you know. I'm not sure I have a firm grip on him yet. The problem with Fat Ollie is that he's in a way likable, you know. He makes you laugh, and this is what makes him such an insidious bigot. Because while you're laughing at him, it's someone you laugh at, you kind of like. And if you like him, then you think, well, I should excuse his little peccadillos. He happens to be a racist, but so what, you know. So he's very dangerous in that respect. And he's dangerous also because he's a good cop. So you respect him as a cop while not quite disrespecting him as a human being. It's a strange mix.
He seems to have excellent timing in this one. He seems to be in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We don't want to tell him why.
Right.
But he is there, yes.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, an interview I recorded with Ed McBain back in September of 2001. Ed McBain was born on October 15, 1926, and he died on July 6, 2005. And Ed McBain was one of the pen names of the author who was born Salvatore Albert Lombino. He legally adopted the name Evan Hunter in 1952, and he was very successful and well-known under that name, but even better known under the pen name Ed McBain, a name he used for most of his crime fiction beginning in 1956. He was a prolific writer. As he mentions during this interview, he wrote under many pen names and aliases, including John Abbott, Kurt Cannon, Hunt Collins, Ezra Hannon, Richard Marston. The list goes on and on. We'll continue with our interview with Ed McBain right after this. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, an interview I recorded with the novelist Ed McBain back in September of 2001. Ed was born in 1926, and his real name was Salvatore Albert Lombino. Born and raised in New York City, he lived in East Harlem until he was 12 years old, when the family moved to the Bronx. He was very much a product of New York City, and he set these novels about this imaginary police precinct in a city very much like New York City, but it had a different name. He attended Olinville Junior High School, then Evander Childs High School, before winning an Art Students League scholarship. Later, he was admitted as an art student at Cooper Union. Lombino served in the Navy in World War II, and in this interview, he talks about how he fell in love with a lot of books and a lot of different authors during his time on a destroyer in the Pacific during World War II. He actually wrote several short stories while serving on board that destroyer. None of them were published until after he had established himself as an author in the 1950s. After the war, Lombino returned to New York and attended Hunter College, where he majored in English and psychology. With minors in dramatics and education, he graduated Phi Beta Kappa. He published a weekly column in the Hunter College newspaper as S.A. Lombino. While looking to start a career as a writer, Lombino took a variety of jobs, including 17 days as a teacher at Bronx Vocational High School in September of 1950. That experience became the basis for his first novel, Blackboard Jungle, in 1954, written under the pen name Evan Hunter. And he really got his start as a writer when he began working at a literary agency and began editing some famous writers. In 1951, he took a job as executive editor for the Scott Meredith Literary Agency, working with authors such as Paul Anderson, Arthur C. Clarke, Lester Del Rey, Richard S. Prather, and P.G. Wodehouse. He made his first professional short story, Sail, that same year, a science fiction tale titled Welcome Martians, credited to S.A. Lombino. Here's more from our interview with Ed McBain.
The book is Money, Money, Money by Ed McBain, a novel of the 87th Precinct. You grew up in East Harlem.
I did indeed.
You're clearly a product of Gotham, of New York City, aren't you?
The big bad city, yeah.
Could you have written these books if you hadn't lived in that kind of a world?
I don't think so. I find it hard to... Well, then again, I have to contradict myself. I wrote a novel called The Chisholms, which was later an 8-part miniseries on television. And it was about the way west, you know, for a family that starts in West Virginia and moves all the way to California across the Great Plain, that, you know, everything that the pioneers did. And I researched that and put myself on a horse for the first time in my life. So I don't know how I think there's something about growing up in a big city with its peculiar mix, ethnic mix and racial mix that I don't think you can research. I think that's something you have to have in you, you know. The same as having the love of the countryside and chickens has to be inbred. You can research it, but I'm not sure I could ever wax poetic about the country. Mm-hmm. You know, the heartland. I'm not sure I could.
Yeah. Ed, you and your dad used to walk over to West Harlem to the Apollo Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Things were a lot different then, weren't they?
I think so. You know, this was at a time when Joe Louis was heavyweight champion of the world. My father had a band. There were black musicians in his band. I think there was a divide. You know, you knew when you were crossing over from East Harlem, which was exclusively white at the time. It's now Puerto Rican, into Black Harlem, which was at the time Negro, as it was called. But when my father and I used to go to the Apollo Theater, we never felt any sense of danger. I mean, the theater would let out at midnight, you know, 11:30, whenever, and we'd walk home, however many blocks it took us. There was never any sense that we were in danger, ever, ever, ever. Never any sense that there was any sort of friction. I don't know. Maybe I had blinders on at the time. I don't know.
Who do you remember seeing at the Apollo?
Ethel Waters, I think maybe Bojangles, I think, maybe.
Bill Bojangles,
yeah,
Robinson.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Wow.
Yeah.
My guest is Ed McBain. His new book is Money, 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 a novel of the 87th Precinct. Do these books always start off with a corpse?
Or someone about to become a corpse, yeah, usually.
You...
The corpse is a long time coming in this one for an Ed McBain novel. You know, usually the corpse is there on either page one or page seven. But this one takes a while for the woman who's going to become a corpse to get there.
But we get a really good inkling at the beginning that she's got potential.
Well, yeah, she's up to no good. You know, when someone's up to no good, something has to happen. It's really interesting because, you know, if I write a book called Lullaby, as I have done, you know that a baby's going to get killed. You know it. If John Updike writes a book called Lullaby, you'd think it's going to be about old folks in a retirement home or something. There's a promise of... For another example, I wrote a book called The Ice, and it starts with a woman, a dancer in a show, and she's the equivalent of New York's Broadway. You know, my city is a mythical one, but she's a dancer in quote, Broadway, a Broadway show. And the show lets out at about 11:30 by the time she's out of the dressing room, and it's beginning to snow, and she's wondering, should she walk home? Or should she take the bus? Because she lives 7-10 blocks from the theater. And she decides by the time she stands on the corner and by the time she might as well just walk. And the minute she says, I'm going to walk, the reader says, please don't walk. Take the bus. Because they know something's going to happen to this poor soul. As it does.
Yeah. Yeah, it almost always happens that way, doesn't it? Would you call it a formula?
It's not. I think it's a convention. You know, I hope that when someone buys a McBain novel, he knows there's going to be a murder in it, and you know, we're not really going to be talking about elephants on the great veldt or the savannah. We're not going to be talking about that. We're going to be talking about murder. For the most part, somebody's going to die, and investigators are going to be called into play to find out what's going on, who did it, usually. In the instance of Money, 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 the murder is really a minor matter in a vast conspiracy that is going on. And so I like to think of them as simple men doing their job in the ragtag end of a big, big city. And suddenly they're into something where everybody's saying, go home, mind your own business, keep out of this. You know, go read your kids a bedtime story, leave us alone. Mm-hmm. Something's going on here.
When I read your stuff, I always get flashes of photographs by Ouija. Remember Ouija?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I do indeed. You mean these... kind of snapshots of real people in real, these little vignettes of big city life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's what lends the series its real body, you know, the fact that you really feel this is a place, this is a huge city where anything can happen and frequently does.
You have a character in the book who is a drug dealer, and
Wiggy the Lid.
Wiggy the Lid, and you make the comment that Wiggy makes more in a year than I think the head of General Motors, or General Electric, or some big
General
corporation.
General Motors, yeah.
Yeah, and you have a lot of fun with this character.
He is fun, yeah. Well, because he also. They're all, everyone in the book is after money. That's why it's called Money, Money, Money. They're all trying to get money in one way or another. And Wiggy, he is called Wiggy the Lid because he frequently blows his wig and is prone to fits of violence. But he is one of the people involved in this sort of comedy of errors where they're all tracking down money that may or may not be counterfeit.
And when we get to the end of the book, I think you answer a lot of questions, but we have a lot more questions, don't we? You leave a lot of stuff unresolved, don't you?
I hope so. I didn't, you know, you're the second person who said this, and I was thinking about it all day today, this morning, actually, I was trying to think, what did I leave unresolved? I didn't intend to leave anything unresolved. Did I make it unclear?
I thought it was by design.
You mean the fate, the government agencies that are involved?
Right. Who's who?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I never clearly said pointed a finger at I never had the guy admit who he was, but he certainly indicates pretty clearly, I thought, who they're involved with, where the backing is, and where it comes from high up in the governmental hierarchy.
Well, we always wonder who the good guys really are. Are these really good guys? The bad guys are usually pretty easy to spot, but the good guys, you're not sure if a bad guy's a good guy or vice versa. It's very confusing.
Yeah. I hoped I indicated that these good guys were bad guys too.
Right.
They're not such great people you want to have for dinner.
Yeah, I think you did. You once responded to an advertisement for a job as an editor, and you went up to the door, and you got there, and you almost turned around and went the other way, didn't you?
Yeah, because it was a literary agency, and I thought, at the time, I thought that the way to break into writing was to get a job at a publishing house, you know, and eventually convince the publishers how good you were, and they'd publish your book. And this said literary agency, and I thought, you know, this is not what I want. It truly is not what I want. And then I said, well, I'm here. So I went in, and the guy who interviewed me was leaving the job. And I said, why are you leaving the job? And he said, because I've been making so much money selling my own stuff that it doesn't pay for me to stay here anymore. And my ears perked up. And I said, how much are you paying? He said, $35 a week. I said, I'll take it. And that's where I really learned about writing. Never mind all the college courses I took. Here I was dealing with editors. I was getting material daily from professional writers like Arthur C. Clarke and P.G. Woodhouse and Mickey Spillane and Poole Anderson, a wonderful science fiction writer, Lester Del Rey, you know, all very good, solid prose. And I was learning from them. And that's where I really learned to write.
And when you first went in the door, they gave you something to edit.
Yeah. It was awful. It was awful by design. They said, read this story and write a letter to the whoever wrote it, to the author of it, and tell him or her why you think it is saleable or not saleable. Because it was a literary agency and their job was to sell stories. And I read the story. It was a terrible, terrible story. And I was irritated by the story and further irritated by the fact that this was in the days of typewriters, you know. Remember typewriters, folks?
I still use one.
Remember radio?
We still use one. Yeah.
The ribbon on the typewriter was torn and it kept catching in the little thing that holds the ribbon. And I was so irritated and I wrote a very angry letter to the fictitious person who had written this story. It was called Rattlesnake Cave, the story was. And they hired me. They said, good, you found everything that was wrong with the story.
We get a lot of different authors on this program, Ed. We get people like you who have obviously written more than one book. And then we get authors who have just written their first book. And a lot of times they'll complain, they'll say, well, the editor wanted to change this and the editor wanted to do that, and I just was adamant, I wanted it the way that I want it. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's amateur night in Dixie, you know, when you think I know more than the editors, I know more than all the people out there. It's not so. When an editor speaks, you know, you just said something a little while ago. You're not an editor, but you're a reader, and you said this was unclear at the end. Well, maybe I should have made it more clear. Nobody pointed that out to me before. But when an editor speaks, I listen. And if I've written books that I still can't sell. I mean, no editor wants, that are still in my closet. I have one book that I think is my masterpiece. I've rewritten it 7 times already, and we've sent it out to I don't know how many publishing houses that have turned it down. with Evan Hunter's name on it, you know? So it's, I listen and I make changes when unless they're outrageous suggestions, but for the most part, I listen to what editors have to say.
Tell us about the masterpiece.
It was to be the story. It still is the story of it sitting there, folks. Anybody wants to buy it? 30 cents. It was first called Hello, I Must Be Going. And it was going to be the story of mankind from cavemen to the present. And the story of our foibles and our involvements in wars forever. And I took it only up to World War II and the whole Nazi horror, you know. And that's where the book ended. But it never sold.
Maybe someday.
Maybe I'll put it on the net, on the internet the way Steve King did.
Sure.
Just a chapter at a time, a dollar a chapter. What do you think?
I think he's the only one who's ever made money off a book on the internet, as far as I know.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing when you think about it.
It is, yeah.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and this is an interview with Ed McBain. We recorded back in September of 2001. Soon after Lombino, Ed McBain's original name, sold some stories under the pen names Evan Hunter and Hunt Collins. The name Evan Hunter is generally believed to have been derived from two schools he attended, Evander Childs High School and Hunter College, although the author himself would not confirm that. He did confirm that Hunt Collins was derived from Hunter College. Lombino legally changed his name to Evan Hunter in May 1952 after an editor told him that a novel he wrote would sell more copies if credited to Evan Hunter than to S.A. Lombino. Thereafter, he used the name Evan Hunter, both personally and professionally. During that period, Hunter also wrote a great deal of genre fiction. He was advised by his agents that publishing too much fiction under the Hunter byline, or publishing any crime fiction as Evan Hunter, might weaken his literary reputation. Consequently, during the 1950s, Hunter used the pseudonyms Kurt Cannon, Hunt Collins, and Richard Marston for much of his crime fiction. A prolific author in several genres, Hunter also published approximately two dozen science fiction stories and four science fiction novels between 1951 and 1956 under the names S.A. Lombino, Evan Hunter, Richard Marston, D.A. Adams, and Ted Tain. Our interview with Ed McBain will continue right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO, an interview recorded in 2001 with Ed McBain. And Ed McBain was a pen name for a writer named Evan Hunter. He first used that pseudonym for his book Cop Hater in 1956, the first novel in the 87th Precinct crime series. Hunter revealed that he was McBain in 1958, but continued to use the pseudonym for decades, notably for the 87th Precinct series and the Matthew Hope Detective series. He retired the pen names Adams, Cannon, Collins, Marston, and Tain around 1960. From then on, crime novels were generally attributed to McBain and other sorts of fiction to Hunter. Reprints of crime-oriented stories and novels written in the 1950s previously attributed to other pseudonyms were reissued under the McBain byline. Hunter stated that the division of names allowed readers to know what to expect. McBain novels had a consistent writing style, while Hunter novels were more varied. Under the Hunter name, novels steadily appeared throughout the 1960s, 70s, and early 80s, including Come Winter in 1973, and Lizzie in 1984. Hunter was also successful as a screenwriter for film and television. He wrote the screenplay for the Alfred Hitchcock film The Birds in 1963, loosely adapted from Daphne du Maurier's eponymous 1952 novelette. In the process of adapting Winston Graham's novel Marnie in 1961 for Alfred Hitchcock, Hunter and the director disagreed on the rape scene, and Evan Hunter was sacked by Alfred Hitchcock. I love that. We'll continue with our interview with Ed McBain on the Best of the Book Nook.
You really got your start selling your work to Pulp Fiction publishers, didn't you?
Pulp magazines, yeah. I used to get a quarter of a cent a word when I first started. Then it went up to half a cent a word. Then a penny a word. Wow, I was in clover. A penny a word. And it was fun because they would call and they would say, do you have a... they were closing out a magazine, and they would say, we need a 2,000-word story to fill up, you know. And if this was science fiction, I would check our files. We were, after all, a literary agency, and see if we had a 2,000-word science fiction story. If we didn't, I went home and wrote it that night, and we sent it in the next day, and that was it.
Now,
this is why I used to use so many different names, you know, when I first started writing.
And sometimes the magazine would have five pieces by five different authors, yeah, but they were all you.
They were me, but and the editor didn't know it because, you know, we sent it from the agency with different pseudonyms on.
Is it true that sometimes they would just give you an illustration and mm-hmm. say, write a story about this?
Absolutely. Well, not just me. They would send it, the cover to the agency. These were pulp magazines, you understand. And they would send the cover to the agency and say, we want X to write a story for this, to illustrate the cover. And they would give you the word count. You know, we need a 5,000-word story to illustrate, or we need a 10,000-word novelette to illustrate the cover.
I can remember as a little kid walking by the newsstand and seeing magazines like, I remember Argosy and True and Men, and they'd have these really wild covers on them. Is this what you're talking about?
No, this was even before Argosy and True.
Okay.
Oh, True was nonfiction, all nonfiction. Argosy was a step up from the pulps. It was a men's adventure magazine. It published mysteries as well, detective stories. But the pulps were a step below that. The covers were usually in the primary colors. They usually depicted a woman in jeopardy, normally threatened by an oriental or a bug-eyed monster if it was science fiction. And, you know, her clothes were in tatters or about to come off. And they were printed on this very low-grade paper, which is why they were called pulps. You could often see the wood grain in the paper. You know, they were sort of yellowish, and uh-huh. it wasn't this was as opposed to the slicks. The slicks were Ladies Home Journal, Cosmopolitan, where the paper was shiny and slick. It was called those the slicks. What an education here today, my God.
This is great. I love it. Ed McBain has joined us in the Book Nook, and it's the first time he's ever been here, and the realization of a dream for me. And Ed has a website. It's www.edmcbain.com if you want to check it out. I'm sure there's a lot of interesting stuff there. I'm going to check it out. You went away. You graduated from high school when you were 16, and you enlisted in what, 1944 in the military?
November of 44, yeah.
And you went away, and while you were gone, you discovered some great books.
Yeah. Well, I was on a destroyer in the Pacific, and they had the people back home were sending books, you know, and there were tons of books to read on the ship, and I made acquaintance with Howard Fast, who was writing some wonderful books about America and the Revolution, and Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler. I'm leafing. This is a long time ago. I'm leafing through the books I read back then. Pearl Buck, a whole wide range of material. Thorne Smith, who used to write these zany, madcap novels. A whole wide range of books that I don't think I would have read otherwise if I hadn't been you know, just digging into a bin full of books there and pulling out one that looked good.
Now, your parents strike me, from what I've heard, as being very different people. Your mom wasn't convinced that you really were serious about writing, and then she got you a typewriter.
She bought me a typewriter, yeah, my first typewriter.
What made her think that you were serious? That you were really wanting to do this?
Probably my father. My father in bed one night said, "But let's buy him a typewriter." Because my father was the kind of a man, if I went to him and I said, "Dad, let's start a newspaper," he'd say, "Great idea. Let's do it." And the next day there would be a mimeograph machine, or actually it was a hectograph machine back then. Or I'd say, "Dad, why don't we put on a puppet show?" "Great idea." Next thing I know, he's building a stage. And I remember we had some battle scenes in it. I was a kid, and our most recent war at that time was World War I. I remember we had a battle scene on stage, and my father was standing in the wings with his cigar, blowing smoke onto the stage, you know, because it was a gas attack. He was great. He was really so wonderful about encouraging any creative idea I had. So I wouldn't be surprised if he said, "Marie, let's buy him a typewriter."
Wow. When you got back from the war, you took all those courses, but it was really the editing job that really got you in the mind frame.
Yeah.
To write yourself. What was it like to edit some of these big names, the Arthur Clarks, the Poole Andersons?
P.G. Woodhouse was the first time I read a P.G. Woodhouse novel, I went into my boss and I said, "There are a lot of things I think are wrong." And he said, I said, "So what should I do?" He said, "Tell him." Tell him. And I told him. And, you know, he'd been writing. I mean, this was a man who had shows on Broadway and he accepted them. He was a pro. And he said, "Yes, I think you're right." And he changed them and made it right. I made it, you know, what I was just a reader, detecting stuff I thought did not either not make me laugh or did not move the scene forward, and I told them about it.
I get the feeling that even though these books deal with some pretty serious issues and some pretty gory stuff sometimes, that a sense of humor is a key element for you.
Absolutely. Well, you know, with cops, if you ride with cops often enough, you'll recognize pretty soon on that because their job is a dangerous one and a trying one, they deal with it with humor. It's a sort of a gallows humor that infiltrates their daily work. I don't know. When they go home, it's a different story, but when they're on the job, they deal with it with humor most of the time. And I try to reflect that in the books. For example, there's a scene, I'll be reading this scene tonight, by the way, where a woman is in the lion's habitat being devoured by the lions. I'm laughing as I mention it because it's a funny, funny scene. You know, she's out there on the island where the cops can't get to her, nobody can get to her, and she's being eaten by lions. But it's a very funny scene, I think. I know it is because I've read it now at several signings and everybody laughs, so they must think it's funny too.
You have a guy who's not a cop, but he's still pretty funny, Wilbur the Burglar. This is a pretty hapless guy.
Wilbur Struthers, yes. I don't know why I like to write about burglars. I had a burglar in another book. I can talk about it more freely than in this book because I don't want to give away too much of the plot of Money, Money, Money. But in the book I wrote called The Big Bad City, one of the subplots is a burglar who he's burglarizing an apartment in the afternoon, you know, which is burglars like to go, crib burglars anyway, crib apartment house burglars. go in when they think the apartment is empty. You know, they don't like to go in at night when people are sleeping in an apartment. They like to go in when people are working during the day. And this guy goes in at 3 in the afternoon, and he stumbles across a man and a woman in bed. And she's in bed with a delivery boy or something, and, you know, it's a whole comedy of errors that takes place. But I like writing about burglars. Cops, I think of burglars sort of as like gentlemen, even though they're not. I mean, they're stealing your goods. But the cops think of them as sort of a crime that's, they almost think of it as a victimless crime, which it is not, of course. I like to write about burglars, and Wilbur Struthers is a nice burglar. He gets involved. He too gets involved in this vast search for what is real and what is not.
Do you write every day?
Every day. Well, not weekends. When I was first starting to write, I used to work. I had a day job, obviously, at the literary agency, and I used to write at night after dinner, and on weekends. And I vowed back then, if ever I was lucky enough to be able to write full time, I would never again write at night or on weekends, and I don't.
Well, Ann, it's really been a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much.
It's been a joy being here. I enjoyed it a lot. Thank you.
My guest has been Ed McBain. The book is Money, Money, Money. You've been listening to Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening.
You have been listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO, an interview I recorded with Ed McBain. And back on the afternoon of Monday, September 10th, 2001, Ed McBain arrived here at the studios of WYSO, where we did a live interview on the air to talk about his novel, Money, Money, Money. It's the only interview I ever had with Ed McBain. He had been scheduled to come through Dayton for a book signing earlier that year. He had to cancel because he was in some health situations that made it impossible for him to travel. And he recovered enough to come through and do that interview in the fall of 2001. And after he did the interview, he went into Dayton for his book signing. The next morning, he flew to Chicago. And when he got off the plane, he found out that his beloved New York City had just been attacked September 11th, the morning of that Tuesday. We all know what happened at the World Trade Center. All the planes were grounded. Ed McBain was stranded in Chicago. His book tour was canceled. He got in a car and drove back to New York City, which was still smoldering and smoking after the attacks on the World Trade Center. The city he loved had been changed forever, as evidenced by his voice during that interview. He had been a heavy smoker for many decades. When we recorded that, he was 75. Evan Hunter, Ed McBain, had had 3 heart attacks over a number of years. His first took place in 1989. In 1992, he was found to have a precancerous lesion on his larynx. It was removed, but the problem returned later. Ed McBain, Evan Hunter, died from laryngeal cancer in 2005. He was 78, and that was in Weston, Connecticut. He was quite a writer. I had not listened to that interview since it was originally recorded. I had never listened to it until just the other day. And what an amazing interview he gave. He talked about his influences. He talked about how he became a writer. He talked about his process. He recounted going to the Apollo Theater with his father, walking through Harlem at night, and never being afraid. He was born Salvatore Albert Lombino, October 15th, 1928. They don't make writers like Ed McBain anymore. It was rumored that among his prolific output of books, that he had written pornographic novels, but he always denied it. Supposedly, he wrote them under the name of Hunter. Not Hunter. No, he didn't write under the name of Hunter. Otherwise, they would have known it was him. He wrote them under the name of Hudson, but he denied it. Apparently, his literary agent, Scott Meredith, sold books to a company as Evan Hunter's work and received payments for those books in cash. While notable, this is of itself not definitive proof that Evan Hunter actually wrote them. Meredith almost certainly forwarded novels to this publisher by any number of authors, claiming they were written by Hunter simply to sell them. 93 novels were published under this name between 1961 and 1969. And even the most avid proponents of Evan Hunter as Hudson do not believe that he could have written 93 pornographic novels and published them over the course of 8 years. As prolific as he was busy doing other things. The Best of the Book Nook comes your way now and then here on WYSO. I hope you enjoyed it.